Part of the Contemporary Halacha series, we welcome Rabbi Kenneth Brander, Dean of the Center for Jewish Future, to discuss a Rabbi's Guide to Pesach Preparation.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. The first and very important disclaimer is this is called a Rabbi's Guide to Pesach Preparation. So I just want to start off with the following statement. I am not a posek, which means the following. I'm going to share with you the way I've approached certain issues regarding preparation for Pesach, and I will at times indicate that you should speak to a posek on these issues. I will share with you why I have come to these conclusions, but I will also indicate at certain points why I think it's important that as you develop as B'nai Torah, and perhaps hopefully some or most of you as future leaders of the Jewish people in a very practical perspective as pulpit rabbis, that you might want to get some additional knowledge on these issues. So I just want to start off with that appropriate parameter. Okay, so before we start off with looking at the handout, there's just a few things that I think are important to recognize as a rabbi's practical guide to Pesach. And that is, while Pesach might be viewed as a Chag of Cheirus, and as is clear from the Shulchan Aruch, that it's a time that has to be a time of simcha for both men and for women, so much so that there is a minhag or a halacha that one should buy one's spouse special clothing for the chag or special gifts for the chag. Sometimes we're not sensitive to the fact that there can be great tensions in a family because of the pressure of Pesach. Because of the time that sometimes goes into what is often viewed as Pesach cleaning, which is really spring cleaning, and more importantly, or equally as important, as the cost. That the cost of making Pesach and buying poor man's bread at $29.95 a pound can create certain challenges for people, and they should not be ignored. So two important ha'aros to begin with is, you will know which families in your community have certain family challenges, and you will know which families have certain financial challenges. So it might pay to be a little proactive and not to speak to them 4 days before Pesach after there's already been a collapse within the home, but rather speak to them even before Purim and say, I know Pesach's coming, and I know you're going through marriage or issues. I wouldn't say it exactly like that, but I know there's some issues that you're going through. Let me help you as you prepare for Pesach to make sure that Pesach Zman Cheirus, Zman Cheiruteinu, does not become, you know, Zman, I'm just playing on the words here, you know, Geirush Teinu, you know, it's the time of becoming, you know, Grusha or anything else of that nature. And I'm not joking about it. I'm saying it in a joking way. But unfortunately, I'm not joking about it. You know, Rabbi Orlean has a synagogue of newly married. He might not always see this, but I'm sure he does see this already himself in his synagogue. And when the family grows and it's not just two people, and the biggest issue they have to decide is, do they go to the in-laws or the outlaws for which days, and how do they deal with it, and the challenges about that, and do they have 15 minutes for themselves, and their privacy, and other issues, which I'm sure are major issues in some people's minds. But the bottom line is, when you have families that are a little bit larger than that, a little bit more significant than that, and there are financial challenges, I want to highlight the fact that unfortunately this Chag of Freedom can become a Chag of great distress. So the first thing I want to focus on is the fact that a Rav should recognize that before we go through the details of Liban, Liban Kal, and the different Iroi Kli Rishon, and all those other important halachas, critical halachas, to be concerned about various Isurim on Pesach, there's a meta Isur, a meta concern that I want to point out to you, and that is that, you know, there's a difference between cleaning for Pesach and spring cleaning, and the time and often the cost that comes along with this can create difficulties with couples who may have food expenses, food challenges with expenses to begin with. And we as Rabbanim or future Rabbanim have to be proactive in helping to deal with those issues. That's item number one. Item number two, you will find that you know, at the point in time in which you might find that you have an assistant in the synagogue, like a, and I don't mean an assistant rabbi, but a secretary, and she gets the same question, or she gets takes a message for you for the same question over and over again, does quinoa need supervision on Pesach or not? There are some questions where maybe the secretary can respond on your behalf, and there are some questions that may have a little bit more of a nuance that you have to train your wonderful professionals, which questions she should feel comfortable in answering or suggesting that she just should look in this synagogue guide, and which questions she should not be comfortable in answering. So maybe whether quinoa needs hashgacha or whether Advil is kosher for Pesach or not, she might be able to answer, or is it kidneyous and stuff like that. But regarding other issues, then it becomes a little bit more of a challenge. And I have found, unfortunately, that sometimes the greatest poskim of our generation of answering our congregational shilas are not the rabbanim, but the secretaries, and some of them actually are not even Jewish. So doesn't mean they don't know more than the Jewish ones, but it's important to just recognize what, again, since this is a rabbinic class on the practical halacha, this is very practical, and it is a very important issue. Okay, so let's now go to some important halachic issues, and that is certain issues regarding of chametz in general. So if we can open up our handout to page one, there's a few sources here that are important. We start with Sif Aleph again. I assume that everyone can read these sources on their own, so I'm just going to paraphrase them. Where the Shulchan Aruch explains the various forms of chametz and explains that it's best to take chitim for matzah, but you actually can use any of the five forms of grain for matzah. So somebody who has certain challenges regarding celiac or any other issues might want to use other types of matzahs, or they're very expensive, but they can be used. And then we're introduced to the chumrah of the Ashkenazic community, and that is that certain forms of kitnios we don't consume. And the Rama explains, v'yesh osrim, v'aminig v'ashkenaz l'hachmer v'ein l'shanos. Mi'u pashit d'ein osrim b'di'eved, and then he speaks about issues of b'di'eved. And we'll get into that in just a moment, but I would just like to drill a little deeper into the kitnios issue with source number two, where the Mishnah Berurah explains that there are really, at least the way, you know, where the Mishnah Berurah explains, you know, what, why that since these types of, since kitnios, any type of legumes that do not rise the way the five grains rise, therefore, they're not in the category of chametz, but in the carriers of kitniot. And the Mishnah Berurah has really two reasons why we were concerned about creating the kitniot. One was that sometimes they were bound together, or maybe they were grown right next to each other, and therefore you could have a situation where that the kitniot itself could actually have chametz mamish as part of it, if they're bound together or if they're grown together. Or the other concern that the Mishnah Berurah mentions is the idea of there being a concern that people will see that you can create kemach from wheat, and you can create kemach from rice or anything else of that nature, and they'll just think that the same way they will not recognize that there's a halakhic distinction between the two, and therefore anything that create a form of wheat to it, the Chachamim, the Ashkenazic community, forbid one to consume. So there's two reasons. Reason number one, again, is the cross-growing between chametz, between the five types of wheat and legumes, and like orez and things of that nature, and the concern about the fact that when they're made into a powder and they look like a wheat-like substance, people are not going to recognize that there's a difference between the two. Those seem to be the two reasons the Mishnah Berurah gives. Now, it's important to recognize that one of those reasons actually has halachic both those reasons have halachic consequence, but for example, getting back to that quinoa question. So for example, in a case of quinoa, where most poskim permit one to consume quinoa, at least to the best of my knowledge, all the major kashrut organizations, the OU, the Star K, the CRC, and others. The OU Asr. What? Oh, that's why they ask? Okay. The CRC and the Star K say it's fine. What?
Many supermarkets don't like presenting in those supermarkets. They just say they have in the store the businesses to consult your rabbi.
Okay, so fine. Again, I'm not a post-sec. I'm just CRC and the Star K say it's fine. But the bottom line is, even the CRC and the Star K, because of the reasons here, where now they have found that last year in particular, or over the past year, that quinoa was growing near other of forms of chametz, they now want there to be supervision. So the supervision is there to make sure that one of the reasons mentioned in the Mishnah Berurah, and that is that they shouldn't be bound together or connected in any way, shape, or form, is still there. So therefore, they're only giving supervision on quinoa that isn't grown with chametz, that isn't grown next to it, and therefore they're being very careful, as opposed to in the past where they didn't do that. And the reason why the halachic agencies, again, I'm not familiar with why Rebelsky says it's usur, but it could be, and the reason why the halachic agencies have no problem with it, even though it could be, again, it looks very much like kitniot, is based on the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, where Rav Moshe Feinstein explains that the gzera of kitniot is limited to the period of time of in which the gzera was created and not created on additional materials that might look like kitniyos. This is the Rav Moshe Feinstein. I think I put the tshuva in here. Yeah, page 3, hopefully. Page 3. And that is, where Rav Moshe Feinstein says that peanuts, he did not find that peanuts would be a problem with issues of kitniyot, because his springboard for the conversation was about potatoes. You can create, yes.
But we clearly don't hold by the tshuva of Moshe, A, because we ask for corn, and B, because now they don't ask for peanuts.
There are some who clearly don't follow the tshuva, the follower of Moshe, but there are some who's, I'm just explaining what.
Okay, the CRC says that they don't put a hashtag peanuts for Kesef anymore.
Well, you'll see they actually acknowledge this is the reason why they have no problem with quinoa. If you read their materials, you'll see that they say, based on this tshuva, why they have no problem with quinoa. It's a good question. What? I don't know. Good question. What? Yes? That what?
And they would say the quinoa is not.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm just, if I can just go through the, again, go through the tshuva, just mention the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, where Rav Moshe Feinstein, I understand your question, it's a good question, but the tshuvas that are the poskim that permit quinoa are saying that the permissibility of quinoa is based on the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, where Rav Moshe Feinstein clearly indicates that that there is, once the gzera was made, they do not include additional materials on that gzera. That is the reason, and I'll show you some of the sources I prepared in the handout, that both the CRC and the Star K say that they don't have a problem with quinoa, of permitting quinoa, and they use this tshuva as their springboard for the conversation. So I think it's just important to recognize the fact that there were two reasons for kitniyot, and we just have to still recognize that if we're not sensitive to both reasons, we're at least sensitive to one of the reasons. Getting further in some of the ideas, and that is one of the concerns I mentioned was how exactly do we deal with issues of preparing the house for Pesach. So it's important for us to recognize, and the sources that I have for you on page 1, source 3, source 4, source 5, and source 6, but all speak about the important ideas regarding preparing for Pesach. The first idea that needs to be recognized is that we say an issue, one of the ways that we clean for Pesach is simply a statement of bittul. I state that I have nothing to do with the chametz, and from a biblical perspective, that's sufficient. The Rabbanim felt that that wasn't enough, for obvious reasons, that if you see chametz in your rishus, you might think you might come to eat it, and therefore they felt that you do need to clean. You still need bittul in case you discover the chametz or you didn't clean properly. But the bottom line is, we both do bittul as well as we do cleaning in order to make sure we get rid of our chametz properly. But the Shulchan Aruch is pretty clear that we need to only check the places that Shema Hichnisu Behem Chametz, that, you know, where there might be Chametz. So if you haven't been in a room until last Pesach where you did spring cleaning on it, there's a good chance you don't have to do it. You probably don't have to clean ceiling fans. It's a pretty good chance you don't need to change the filters and air conditioners. And in fact, there's a lot of places. Well, when you have little children, so even places that you thought there weren't chametz, there might be chametz. But assuming you're talking to people who don't have little children, then I think it's important to recognize the fact that cleaning for Pesach, other than the kitchen, may take, you know, a half a day or a day of total time, but it doesn't need to take 2 months. And I think it's important for us, to make that comment. So if we never bring chametz into the garage or anything else of that nature, so then, you don't need to clean the garage for Pesach. Again, if you have kids around, even those closets that you thought you never put chametz in might have chametz, so you have to be a little bit more careful. Since you can read this on your own, the crumbs that are not edible for a dog or anything else like that nature, I don't need to worry about it. So let's say, behind my stove, if I have crumbs that are not royal achilas kelev, or crumbs that are less than a kazayas, that would be inedible to a human, so I don't need to worry about that. Now, that doesn't mean that people don't try to, you can spray a little... bleach, in a crevice behind your ovens and stuff of that nature. And if you're concerned that there might be some crumbs there, you can just spray a little bleach, and it will destroy the credibility of the crumbs from a perspective of whether they're royal achilas kelev, because they become poisonous. But the bottom line is that it's just important to recognize, if it's easy to vacuum behind there and stuff like that, that's fine. But to remove your whole oven behind your oven and to clean in ways in which, that are extremely difficult, again, I think we have to measure the responsibilities that we have from halacha, which are clearly defined. And that is requiring us to clean the area, requiring us to do bittul, requiring us to sell the chametz that we might still have left. But there are protocols, and that is, if you've never been in that room before, you don't need to clean it. If there are crumbs that are not royal achilas kelev, you don't need to worry about it. And if they're less than a kazayas, which is around 30 grams, and they're inedible to a human, then you don't have, you don't have concerns about those either. Are there any questions on that? Okay. So, with that in mind, I'd like to be concerned about the greater issues, but let's just go through some of these sheets that I put together first. And that is, I'd like to go through the most important thing, and that is cleaning the kitchen and koshering the kitchen for Pesach. So let's just go through these. The sources that I provided for you on page 1 and page 2, other than the source in Kitniot, is all of the issues that I just mentioned to you about various levels of kazayas, about where you have to check or not check. And those sources are pretty easy to read. You'll just read them on your own. Page 3, we went through that. Page 4 is, I obviously have some affinity to the Boca Raton Synagogue, so I'm going to use this as a model of something I think is important for rabbis to give out. If you turn to page 5, again, we're going to run through this very fast. Page 5 is just a list of, what the Pesach is, Pesach's all about. I just want to point out some things here. They're not halachic, but they're important from a programmatic perspective, and I think that that's important to recognize. you know, Rabbanim give Shabbos HaGadol Shiurim. It's important that we try to make sure that those are accessible. You know, in some communities, Shabbos HaGadol Shiur has no different in the amount of people than a Shiur has between Mincha and Maariv, and I think in some ways that's tragic. But, you know, for example, if you do small things like doing something for childcare so that both men and women can go to the Shiur, so you have childcare or babysitting and things of that nature, you'd be amazed how you can do things. If you have as you can see here, if you have a little dessert reception before Mincha, you'd be surprised what a few chametz sticka cookies can do to the growth of your Shabbos HaGadol Shiur. And there's no reason to ignore teens. You know, teens obviously have a different focus. You might want to have a different focus for them. But whether you give the Shabbos HaGadol Shiur to the teens on your own, which is a separate one, but there's nothing wrong with sensitizing the next generation of young people that they should be involved with the community and they should be involved with learning. Do something for teens. It doesn't have to be a formal shiur. It could be something a little bit more informal, but it's not a bad idea to think about those types of issues. Other than that, there's some pretty standard things here, and that is, you know, the Erev Pesach routine and dealing with issues of the tainus and the siyumim and things of that nature. And there's not much more to say about this. The issue regarding page 6, page 7, page 8, page 9, are all basically standard, nice summaries that you can have for your congregation, and I think it's important to have. Page 10 is a little bit more halachic in nature, and that is a form of being able to sell your chametz. It's a pretty standard form. I think the things that you need to worry about is issues regarding when a rav sells the chametz and he lives in a community where people are going to be in different parts of the world. You have to make sure that you sell a person's chametz when it's still not yet Pesach for them. So if you're, you know, selling a person's chametz and you live in New York and they're in Eretz Yisrael for Pesach, you need to sell the chametz earlier. You need to inform them that, it's not really a realistic situation, but, you know, if they have some chametz that they're selling with you that's in Eretz Yisrael in some strange way, that they can't eat that chametz until you buy back the chametz, so, you know, they have to wait a little bit longer. But the bottom line is, you have to make sure you sell the chametz, you need to sell chametz earlier. So you might sell the chametz, let's say, the night prior to when you sell it for everybody else. You need to make sure that you tell people regarding based on where they're going to live, where they're having Pesach. And that's why it's important that this document, however you want to put this document together, is almost irrelevant. But the idea of different time zones, I think that has a halachic significance to it. And even that, even in this thing, but no one reads, if you give it, you know, if you are in a different time zone, you have your chametz with you, consider your chametz sold effective, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's just important to tell people that, because in your zeal to help people and sell their chametz, sometimes they don't realize that it's predicated on the time zones that you're selling and not in the time zones that they're living. And therefore, we can be over a significant isurim if we just wait to sell our chametz where people are traveling when you're selling it at a time where it's already Pesach for them, and can create significant halachic challenges for them after Pesach is over. So that's just an important thing to realize, that you can't sell all the chametz at the same time. We can skip the next page. You can look at that on your own. The quinoa issue, I'm happy someone brought it up, but the quinoa issue is mentioned here. And as you can see here, the star K, based on Reb Moshe Feinstein's, the fourth column, you know, clearly indicates that it's based on the tshuva that I mentioned, and it's not just here, but it's not just the star K who writes this, but the CRC, and most other major kashrut organizations are using this, you know, are doing this based on that. And again, I just point this out because of the halachic components to it. On the second column on page 12, last season the Star Case sent one of the mashgichim and found that the quinoa fields in Bolivia, you think the CGF goes to crazy places, and the Star Case ensured that the farmers do not rotate their crops. And then they realized that some of the challenges, that there was some that there was no concern of intermingling with barley, but then they realized that there might be, and therefore now there is supervision given. Okay, before we go any further in this, I want to just talk about issues regarding koshering the kitchen. Okay, so as we all know, there's various forms of koshering. There's libun, which is a form of incinerating the be'en, and therefore there's libun gamar, and then there's libun kal. There's hagala, there's iru rotzchim, and there's milu v'iru. There's a form of soaking. So there's purging through pouring hot water, or there's purging through dumping in hot water. There is also libun. So as everyone hopefully here knows, that we kosher and we expel a taste, assuming that it is possible to expel the taste, we kosher in a way that is at least as intense as any heat that would have that the object would have absorbed with. So, in other words, if you're using an oven, you need to make sure that whatever heat that oven used, you want to make sure that you create a heat source that is as intense or more intense than that than was ever done in that oven. So let's go through some of the various forms of ovens and just go through this. The easiest one to clean is a self-cleaning oven. A self-cleaning oven that you put on a three-hour cycle or something of that nature is a machaya, because it really, it's mamish. It's a form of libun gomer. Or almost libun gomer. It's mamish. Like, it's creating an intense heat there that everything gets singed and becomes, charcoal basically. However, even a self-cleaning oven, it's important to realize that not always is a self-cleaning oven, the inside face of the oven door, as well as some of the outer rim of the oven, is not necessarily totally clean during the cycle. And therefore, one should make sure that one uses Easy Off, and there's Easy Off that is for, well, let me take a step back. I found that I was in charge of the Hashkacha called the ORB, which was Orthodox Rabbinic Board of Broward and Palm Beach Counties. And, Mashkichim, I remember one of the cooks told me, I won't act out the voice, but the bottom line is the cook told me, Rabbi, I heard that 600,000 Jews left Israel. I feel like I'm cooking for all of them, as I'm preparing this hotel for Pesach. And, sometimes mashkichim are blowtorch happy. And I have to tell you, the amount of thermostats that get broken 2 days before Pesach because mashkichim just go around with a blowtorch as if it's, they just are not careful and they just break thermostats. My point is that as we go through the kashrut of this, even though we're not focusing on industrial kashrut, we're focusing on kashrut of the home, we also have to be sensitive to certain issues. So I bring that up because when you do a self-clean cycle, you should just be very careful that you don't leave the house for those 3 hours, because you should be in the house, because the self-clean cycle sometimes can create excessive heat, and just for safety, I think it's better, not to leave the house for that period of time. And also, sometimes you might want to say you try to get two things done at the same time. I'll do the self-clean cycle, and then I'll do the stovetop at the same time. I'll turn on all the burners at the same time. The ovens are not made for that. Even the ones that have, those kosher even the ones that have, the Shabbos modes are not meant for people to kosher the top and use a self-clean cycle at the exact same time. So I would do those in two steps, not because of halachic issues, but because of making sure that part of your Pesach responsibility is not buying a new oven prior to Pesach. And so it's important that you clean the area, that you clean the areas around the face of the oven itself. You'll see that there's a gasket around like the window area there and other areas that should be cleaned with a self-cleaning product that is made for self-cleaning ovens, because if you use an easy oil product that's not, again, you'll be fine for Pesach, but you will have in some ways compromised the coating on the oven that is used for the self-clean material. Now the racks inside the oven, if they're koshered with the self-cleaning cycle, then they're koshered also. I mean, that's more intense heat than they'll ever get. And that you should check, but most manufacturers say that there's no problem whatsoever with the racks keeping there. In fact, what we do is we have the self-cleaning, the top of the oven, the stove top, we actually take the stove top has grates on top of it that actually cover the entire surface of the stove. We actually take those stove top grates and I put them in the self-clean cycle, so I'm actually koshering it all in one fell swoop, or at least those parts in one fell swoop, and then I just, you know, clean the underbelly of the where the grates are, and turn on all after it's gone through a self-clean cycle. Then turn on all of the burners for like 15 minutes or so, and that's it. If for some reason you're told that the racks cannot handle the self-clean cycle, so if you put them on the highest temperature, which is usually 550 degrees, and you put them on for 45 minutes or so, that will do the same thing. Okay, that's a self-cleaning oven. That's the most normative oven. So we're going to go to any questions on that? Anyone ever hear differently on that? Okay. Let me go through some other ovens, but we should just know them anyways. Continuous cleaning ovens, you should clean those properly. Turn them on for 450 degrees for an hour or so. So what that does is that creates the continuous clean mechanism to begin to work. If you see afterwards that spots don't disappear, you should then turn on the oven again, and here I think you should turn it on for like 2 hours or so to allow the continuous clean mechanism to do a deep clean, and then you'll see basically that those spots will be like charcoal, and there's nothing more to be concerned about. But normally, turning it on for 450 degrees for an hour will make a difference. Now, what I many times did as a Rav in these cases, because I'm giving you approximates, when I got, I would call the various companies. I would just Google, I would do continuous clean ovens, and I would see one or two of the major companies. I would just call, and I would explain to them what I'm looking to do. Sometimes they actually had gotten a few phone calls like that already, and sometimes I was the first guy to ask the question, or first person to ask the question. And they'll tell you, this is how you make sure your cleaning mechanism gets to the most intense thing. Keep it on for two hours at 450 degrees. It'll kick in and it'll singe everything there. So that's a good thing to do yourself also, to make sure that you do that. Now, a conventional oven, you know, I guess the Heights apartments don't have self-clean ovens, right? They have the standard ovens, right? So there, you have to, check all the areas. You have to clean them really well. Use that Easy Off, acoustic Easy Off cleaner. Some of the spots, you might have to do a second application to get some of those spots off. And then I would, wait 24 hours, and then I would kosher it by leave and kal, which is basically turning it on broil for 550 degrees, or the highest setting, 550 degrees, but I think broil is better. I don't know exactly what the settings are here, but either one of those should work. For like 50 minutes, that should be enough. Now, especially those ovens, I would not kosher the stovetop simultaneously, because you'll have a meltdown. And that's it for that. Let's talk about any questions about ovens? I want to do the cooktops, but any questions about the ovens themselves? Okay. The cooktops. Again, sometimes the grates can be koshered simultaneously. Yes?
Did you just say this, but to clarify, you have to wait 24 hours to have it before you do anything?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because it's a in a case in which you're using a self-cleaning oven, you don't have to wait 24 hours. But if you're doing the other things, which is just like a leave and call, I think you should wait 24 hours. What? I don't think we're leaving. I think with leave and call, you should wait 24 hours. Wait a second. No, maybe you're right. I wrote the Boca Raton Synagogue thing. Oh, I think you're right. I don't think you need it. Yeah, I wrote in here and I did the research that you should wait 24 hours before you do it. If you do it a self-cleaning oven, you should you have to wait 24 hours because then it's mamish purging it all out. But if you're just doing a leave and call, I think you have to wait 24 hours. Again, you're more than welcome to ask any of the poskim if they say you don't have to wait 24 hours, then don't wait 24 hours. But I think you really do have to wait the 24 hours before you do it. In a situation where you're not doing a total leave-in. This is just leave-in kal, and therefore I think you do have to wait the 24 hours after you clean it.
The Mishnah Berurah doesn't like leave-in kal in general, but when he says that Makom Hesed Meruah Minias Simchas Yom Tov Luhu Eino Ben Yomo Meis Shenish Tamji Vol Chameis Teish Lusmot B'Diyad that I'll post in the Sofer Nechameis Mikri A Terabal of the Dai B'Mashe Echshir V'Hagalo Believing Kal.
Okay, so he still should wait 24 hours. If you're not, whatever. There's a whole. I mean, listen. You always will have people who call you 15 minutes before the time that you still are able to kasher and say, I forgot. I didn't. You know, I need these kosot. My grandfather used these kosot or something like that. So whatever. So you in those types of cases. You know, I'll tell them to, you know, well, not with silver, because you'll destroy silver, but in certain cases, I'll tell them to put some type of bleach in the, when they do a gala or something of that nature, because then you don't have to, that will deal with your ben yomo problem. But the bottom line is, we're here to talk about standard ways of doing it, and the standard way of doing it, I think people should be trained in their own homes, and in the homes they're going to, again, engage as Rabbanim, that you should wait 24 hours. It's not a, we're not talking, it does not, it's not Maniyah Simchas Yantif. We're not, you know, we're doing this before Yantif, and people should prepare properly. If you send out the materials to them, not 15 minutes before Yantif, or a week before Yantif, but you send it out to them, you know, right after Purim, or something like that, which is when I think these materials should go out, people have more than enough time. And if 2 weeks beforehand, you just create a Sunday morning, where there can be a conversation on all of these issues, people have more than enough time to plan their schedules, and I think they should wait the 24-hour period of time. Yes? Right. 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 If you are, you know, if the way you're celebrating, that's true for any of the koshering.
I mean, they should be clean to make sure there's no, like,
well, one second. We're talking about any koshering, not cleaning. I didn't say you don't have to clean. I'm talking about koshering. Koshering, this is not about cleaning. It's about koshering. But koshering, you don't have to kosher unless you're going to use it. In other words, if I'm not using my barbecue, which is extremely difficult to kosher, okay, if you have the capacity to kosher it at all, but let's assume you do have the ability to do it, the bottom line is I don't have to kosher it. I should still, in my own home, I should make sure that there aren't, you know, crumbs all over the countertops and stuff like that. I should clean, but I don't have to kosher. We're talking about koshering. Yes?
You have to put away items that you're not going to use, like microwaves, let's say. There's no, like, chametz be'en.
I think if there's no chametz be'en in it, you don't have to put it away. You can just tape it to make sure you don't use it. If you have a toaster, like, for example, I'll put away the toaster because there's chametz in that toaster. No matter what you try to do to it, I'll clean it, I'll take the trap out, I'll do my best to clean it out, but there's the toaster I'll put away. But if I'm not going to use the microwave, I'll just put a piece of tape over it just to remind me not to, or remind anyone in the house that it's not kosher for Pesach. Okay? Cooktops. So for cooktops, again, grates can be koshered simultaneously with the oven. If koshering with a self-clean cycle, the grates, you know, you can just put them in there. And again, in that case, you don't need 24 hours because there you're not just doing a Leibun Kal, there you're doing a Leibun Gamor. You're basically, you know, you're just blowing the thing up. But the bottom line is, in a standard conventional electric top, one needs to clean the burners well and then turn them on to the highest heat until they're glowing hot. And the drip pans, again, depending on which POSIC you follow, some people say once you turn that on, it's good enough. The drip pans don't need to be koshered any more than that. I actually have a little bit of a challenge with that because I don't think you really get those drip pans really to the heat sources that they need. I think that you should just cover the drip pans with a heavy-duty aluminum foil. But there are poskim either way in that. The remaining cooktop areas should be cleaned and covered. But if you haven't, you know, unless you're going to blowtorch the cooktop, which this probably means you'll need a new cooktop, you know, you should cover the areas that you can with the silver foil. You should cover it. And the knobs, you know, with, you know, which you turn it on, have to be really cleaned. And what I do with the knobs is, you know, I soak them for a little bit or I clean them very carefully. And you know, and that's it. Now, it's important to recognize something, and this is an important kashrut thing in general now. And again, I don't think the Heitz ovens are a challenge in this area, but again, this is a rabbinic guide, not a guide for those who live around YU, and that is in the new ovens, that's why I'm not sure it's a problem in the Heitz, the new ovens, all the ventilation from the ovens don't go in the back or anything else anymore. They actually ventilate through the back burners. Okay? They actually ventilate through the back burners, or they ventilate actually through, you can actually see, they actually ventilate through like three or four, you'll see like a little ventilation, you know, against the back oven wall, stovetop wall. So why am I sharing this with you? Because in our zeal to make sure that we cover the oven top properly, if we cover the place where it is ventilating, you're basically going to create a challenge in your cooking the entire Pesach because your oven won't be regulated properly. So for you'll see, there's not like there's no markers or anything like that. I mean, if there's not, there's not. That's not a big deal. Yeah. Just eat one. If this is your stovetop. So sometimes the ventilation will actually come through here, it'll ventilate through here, or sometimes it will actually, this is the more normal way, you'll see these things will ventilate through here. So my point is that when you cover this area, if you can't, in other words, some of these are just have grates all around it, like the one I have at home has grates, metal grates. So what do? I take these grates, I take them off, they're easy, and I put them in the self-clean cycle, and I clean them self-cleaning, and I'm done. I just put them back, and that's it. And I clean the bottom area, but there's no food that I'm going to worry about on Pesach that's going to touch the bottom area. I mean, I turn on all these, I clean this all out, and do everything I like, so I create a pogrom in the anything that's here, and I turn these all on for the highest time they've ever been on before, so this whole area behind here gets hot also, but basically these grates have been koshered by putting them in the stovetop. But if you couldn't do that for some reason, if your oven isn't consistent like that, and you put aluminum foil or something else, and you cover this area over here, so what will happen is the zeya from the oven won't have a place to escape, and therefore your whole oven system is going to get messed up. So you just keep that in mind. Don't cover that area. Yes.
You like actually have to, like if you're in your oven, you have the grates, and you are just going to cover them with these, like you actually have to clean under the grates because you're not going to see it or get it. Or anything.
Yeah, I don't go crazy about cleaning it, but I just, you know, I turn them all on, I just take a sponge and I just like spray a little thing and I just clean it. I don't think you have to because that's not where the thing's coming from. I just clean it. I don't think you have to worry about it. I think if you're doing the top thing, then you're done. You have nothing to worry about. That's the whole thing. I wouldn't go crazy on that piece. The thing is where the pots are going to where the pots are going to, you know, be placed. And when you move a pot off the stove, off the fire, and you put it on a different, and a different area and stuff like that, all that has to be kosher for Pesach, or it has to be properly covered. So it's important to recognize that issue. And by the way, another serious halachic issue that, again, you should be aware of is, if you're cooking, let's say, pizza, you're cooking pizza in the oven here, right? And it's venting through the back burners, which a lot of them vent through it, and you have a meat pot on here, or something like that, and you have hot zeya coming through this from the pizza, something that you need to, you know, be concerned about. So I'm just pointing, again, I'm not sure, this is not a heights challenge, at least the apartment that I saw in my son's apartment, it does not have a self-cleaning, you know, anything, you just have to, you know, whatever. But the bottom line is that, you're not always going to be in the heights, right? Or most of you aren't always going to be in the heights. And the bottom line is, you should just be sensitive to this. First of all, you might not be eating in the heights for Pesach, and you might be koshering someone else's place. And again, I'm not here to tell you what to do this year. I'm here of issues you should be sensitive to as Rabbanim. That's an issue you need to be sensitive to. Yes?
The metal grates that you put the pot on, those generally can handle the self-cleaning
oven? Yeah. I mean, I called to ask. And they said, you know, they might turn a different color. They might be a little gray after you do it and stuff like that. I don't really care if they're a little gray. And they were a little gray, but only for like, you know, a day. And then they turned back to their, whatever, it didn't really bother me. But you should call and ask them. But normally, there's not an issue. If they tell you there's an issue, I wouldn't do it like that, you know.
Turn on the flame.
Yeah, turn on the flame. And then on the other parts, though, that you haven't turned on the flame, like let's say over here, where the flame's not going to reach, I'd cover that with, like, a good silver foil, or twice with the silver foil, so that it won't rip or something like that. And that's it.
But I always wonder, though, is that the flame only goes on, like, a certain part of it.
Yeah, that's not my concern. My concern is, you cook something over here, right?
Yeah.
And then what happened was, after you cooked it over here, you took it off the stove here, and you put it over here.
Uh-huh.
And it was hot. But you never koshered this area. So what I would just do is either put trivets on here, but that doesn't work when you have like a spider type of a top. Or just cover this with aluminum foil or some type of disc, a metal disc or something like that, so it's not totally on that area. That's what I'm trying to communicate. Perhaps not effectively, but that's what I'm trying to communicate.
The top of the grates.
The top of the grates. Or kosher the grates in a way that just purges any issues. And that way, I think the best way of doing that is either if you can put them in the self-cleaning oven, or if not, you can just, you know, cover this area and have no issues whatsoever. Or you can go to Home Depot and buy a few metal like discs and put them in these areas and just rest on that. And Shalom Yisrael, you have nothing to worry about.
Have you ever researched if drip pans themselves are inserted into...
Yeah, I wouldn't insert drip pans in there. First of all, you can easily buy these plastic these aluminum foil covers for the drip pans. I've never researched it. I don't think they would.
Okay.
And a lot of these ones don't have drip pans anymore, the ones with the self-cleaning. So, the hardest stovetop to cover, to kosher in any way, shape, or form, is a ceramic cooktop for Pesach. That's very hard to do. That's a very hard one to kosher. I mean, to kosher the burning area is pretty easy. You just clean it well, turn on the elements until they glow, and the burning area is now kosher for Pesach. But the question is, how do you kosher the area in between when it's a glass top? So you need some type of libun kal or something else of that nature. But again, that's a little bit challenging to do. So the easiest way to do it is simply just to have, you know, some trivets put over here, clean the area, just put some trivets here, and if you while you're cooking, just move it to here. It's on the trivets, and you're totally fine. Yes.
You can't just put a little foil on top of it.
No, because it will melt in there, and you won't have a problem with koshering because you'll just need to get a new one. Okay. Right. That's why it's harder. okay? Because the ceramic thing won't accept, you know, it won't allow you to do it. And I know that from my own personal experience, where there is an os still, where I put a little aluminum foil once and found out that it doesn't, it just melts in there and you can ruin it. Now, some people suggest, and again, you can only really have a professional do this, so I wouldn't suggest this. I'm just being very clear. I don't suggest this at all. That you can singe this with a singe this area with a blowtorch, and you would kosher it. But there's a 90% chance that if you do that, you're going to just break the top. So I would never suggest that you do that. But if there's some guy you know who's an expert in koshering and stuff like that, that's a good thing to do. Now, in full disclosure, since in Florida, this was the ceramic top was the top of choice that all the builders built into homes. I got this Shaila a lot of what to do. And what I told people to do was one of two things. Actually, I told them to create these trivets, put these trivets on, which is the standard way. Or I did another thing, which I have some remorse about doing, which I actually made a video on how to kosher a ceramic top. The remorse is not because I don't look good in the video, because I don't, but that's not my remorse. My remorse is it's a little bit hard what I suggested to do, and I'll share it with you, but again, if you ever wanted to do this, again, I would discuss it with Poskim, although, like, if you read any of the literature on this stuff, they all say as long as you can create a situation where you can singe, like the Lieb und Kahl, you can singe the ceramic stovetop, that's good enough. You can create a Lieb und Kahl, because there's no way that the heat over here is ever greater than a Lieb und Kahl. So what I told, yes?
It's a glass stovetop.
You can have an electric stovetop where the surface is still metal, and you can have, in other words, and you can have a glass stovetop where the stovetop is plastic. Is a ceramic. It's normally white or black. It's like embedded into the coils are like embedded into the glass. All right, so there are some stovetops where you have an electric, here's other burners, and like you actually can, they're so electric, you can actually take them out, and like they plug into the thing, right? Not a standard plug, but you can actually take them out. That's a standard metal top. Then you have another one that's viewed as fancy, that is really challenging. That is, they're like baked in to the top, and there's actually a light here that reminds you that the top might still be hot even after you turn them off.
And that's real far.
That's electric. But there's two. I just didn't want you to think that every electric's like that. That's real electric. That's total electric. Okay, but the question is, how do you kosher this area over here? Even if you turn these on, you're not going to get this that hot. So either you put trivets there, that's very easy. So then you never will put the stuff on top of this. You just clean it off, you know, and if you use a caustic agent, so again, you created a pgam in the taste, so if it fell on there, you know, it's still okay, but another way of simply doing it is just simply trying to kosher this. So that, from a theoretical perspective, is a very nice idea. From a practical perspective, it is very complicated to do. So once I used to tell people, create a tent over your stovetop of aluminum foil, put bricks around each one of these. Why? So that the tent doesn't fall on here and then melt into there. Turn that on, all of these high. It will trap your heat. And then if you take a piece of New York Times and just run it right over here, you will start to see after you do this for like 15 minutes or less, that the New York Times will totally begin to singe. So, but that has its challenges to it, because number one is you really got to watch this. You got to really watch this. Number two is, who says everyone's going to do this properly? That's why I made a video of it. I'll send you the link to the video. And number three, you have to ask a POSE, even though in the STAR-K manuals or the CRC manuals and other manuals, it will say for this, one of the ways to kosher this is to create a way in which you create a Lieblin Kal. This is definitely Lieblin Kal. But, you know, if you ever, again, I want you to have these in mind so that you should just realize there are multiple ways of doing it, and that's my responsibility here today. Okay? Just want to make sure I'm going on time here. I'm running late. Okay. So I want to just move much faster because I have notes for how to kosher each one of the things. I think I'm just going to send them to you guys. Like a broiler, like for example, the broiler, you can't really kosher since the food is broiled or roasted directly on the pan itself. But what you can do is you can kosher it. If you want to get a new broiler pan, assuming that you need that, you can take the broiler pan out, clean the whole thing out, wait 24 hours, turn on broil, let it, you know, for 40 minutes or so, and then put in a new broiler pan, and then for Pesach, and then you're fine. Oven hoods and exhaust fans have to really be koshered properly. There's been all over those. If you have an oven hood and you put your hand on top of it, sometimes it's even hard to get it off because it's so sticky. You got to at least try to clean it and you know, with some caustic agent so that it loses its chaloshem of chametz in any way, shape, or form once you do that. And if there's a fan there or stuff like that, you should try to clean that out, you know, in a very serious way. If you have, you know, microwaves, the fancy microwaves, the convection microwaves are a little bit more challenging because they have a chamber with a fan and the end can get in that area. So it's important that you recognize that you really need to clean that chamber and that fan. I think a nice way of doing it is, you know, spraying some type of caustic agent in that area. So even if you don't clean it totally, the caustic agent, assuming, again, it's appropriate for the convection microwave, has destroyed the integrity of the chametz from a halachic perspective. So a microwave, the glass plate in the microwave cannot be koshered. So you can just remove the glass plate. I've removed the glass plate every single year, and it's no big deal. You, again, wait 24 hours. You take a cup of cold water and let it boil until the whole chamber is filled with steam and the water overflows the cup. Some people also say that you should still, you know, cover all the foods in the microwaves even after performing this koshering. I'm not sure why you have to do that if it's a good koshering method, but again, my goal here is to tell you what other people say also. So that actually, I don't think that's the problem in that case, because I don't think a simple covering would help, but that is an issue as we move to the next thing, and that is koshering countertops. If you look at the STAR-K and the CRC, and I use the STAR-K and the CRC because unlike the OU that is into products, the STAR-K and the CRC are really the two foremost kashrut organizations that are for the general populations and preparing your homes for Pesach. So therefore, I'm using them as the gold standard. So for example, because of the issue just mentioned, let's talk about countertops. So a natural stone or granite countertop or something, or a wood countertop that has no cracks in it, all you have to do is pour boiling hot water over those, clean them, wait 24 hours, pour boiling hot water over them, and you're totally fine. If you have a ceramic or porcelain countertop, that's not good, and you'll just have to cover it. If you have, like, for example, a Corian countertop, which a lot of people have, that's a polymer or plastic. And since it's a polymer or plastic, depending where you look, because of the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, even though it's many people argue that's not what Rav Moshe Feinstein had in mind, because it's not a soft plastic. It's a hard, hard plastic. You're not worried that it's going to be destroyed. You're not worried about anything like that. And therefore, depending on who you read, that Korean polymer or plastic, which is a polymer or plastic, some people will say that doesn't work to kosher it, and you just have to cover it. I've always told people that you can kosher it, and you just have to pour boiling hot water over it. Most of the poskim feel that way, and therefore I have followed that. And so countertops that have no abrasions, but are either whether they're formica, whether they're butcher block, natural stone, or Corian, as long as they're not scratched or cut up where the chametz can be embedded in there, all you have to do is pour boiling hot water over it. Start from the forest. Like, let's say this is the countertop, and I'm koshering. If I start from over here, I'm not really accomplishing what I want. I start from over here, pour boiling hot water over it, and then pour more boiling hot water until I get to the end. And that's the same thing true with when I do a stainless steel sink. You kosher it by starting with the outside and slowly moving into the inside until you get to the drain area. Yes.
You have to kosher stone.
I think you have to. Yeah, I think you have to pour boiling hot water over. Yes.
If I recall correctly, Rav Schechter had a concern with the countertops that if you might have taken a challah out of the oven and put it on the countertop, that's a davar drush. So he says he might need an oven milubenes.
To kosher countertop?
Yeah.
Whoa. My wife makes challahs every single week. I don't remember her ever putting anything on that because she doesn't put it mamish. The challah itself, or are you putting the what?
The challah itself, otherwise it's the yeah. Or kush would be a
kiri, or kush is a kiri. I don't know. So ask Rav Schechter. If he says you have to do that, then you should do it. But I've not seen one significant posek who publishes on these issues ever say you have to have that concern. But if Rav Schechter says it again, that's why I started out this conversation. There's one thing I'm very sure of. I'm not a posek. Pretty good pulpit rabbi, not a posek. So if Rav Schechter says that, then you have to have that conversation with Rav Schechter. So again, China sinks cannot be koshered. Stainless steel sinks, Korean sinks, granite sinks can all be koshered based on the way I said that you just kosher from the outside, working your way on the inside. Okay. I want to mention one more thing about koshering, but I do want to get to a few other things because I think they're like equally as important. Equally as important than anything else that we've done. When you clean a refrigerator, you'll have a lot of people that will. What they'll do is they'll cover the slotted shelves in the refrigerator. If you cover the slotted shelves in the refrigerator after you just spent $1,000 on your food or in your big freezer, you will destroy all your food because what will happen is the slotted shelves are slotted for a reason. And that is airflow. If you totally cover them, you block the airflow. And what will happen is stuff in your refrigerator will be very cold in certain places, and stuff in your refrigerator will be like it was after Hurricane Sandy. You didn't have electricity for 2 days. Okay? So you have to just, again, these are like the do's and don'ts that's important. If you're a manhig of a community and you're telling them how to kosher and you say, oh yeah, clean out your refrigerator, you can cover the shelves, assuming you have to cover the shelves, you just tell them to cover the shelves. You don't tell them these issues. On your conscience, you know, there will be people who will not have food for Pesach because it will not last the 2 days, let alone if it's a 3-day yontif. It won't last the 2 days because the refrigerator won't have a proper, you know, circulation. Now, if the shelf is not slotted, you don't have to worry about it. But if you look at most refrigerators and freezers now, especially the newer ones, you'll see they all come with slotted shelves. Don't put a hard plastic over it. You know, if you're going to put a piece of tinfoil over it, slot the tinfoil so that there is airflow. On that same issue, I want to mention something about diabetics. Most people will be too embarrassed to tell you whether they're a diabetic or not. But there are serious issues of pikuach nefesh with a diabetic, especially with the Pesach Seder. I did not expect this first part to go as long as it did, but what I had planned to do was a little experiment. I borrowed from someone and I did this beforehand, so I know it would work out in a way that I would able to prove my point. I borrowed from someone a diabetes testing kit, and I bought two bottles of wine, and they're open because I tested this before I was going to do this here. One's a Kedem Concord Red, creamy, smooth red grape wine. And as most Kedems, you know, some of them have sugar added, and some of them do not have sugar added. If you put these two and pretend they're the blood of a diabetic, okay, and you use a testing kit, one will give you a normal, if we would test our blood, you know, if you just ate, so maybe it would be like 150. If you didn't eat, it would be like 100 or less than that. This one will be like 400, and this one will be like 229. If a wine has sugar added to it, and a diabetic is going to drink four cups, you can put that diabetic into a diabetic shock. Or you can definitely challenge his ability to feel Simchas Achag for the next 2 days. He could be lethargic. I'm saying this with a little joke, but I'm not joking. This is like really important, serious stuff. So the halacha requires that the wine has to have 4%. In order for it to be wine, it has to have a 4%. Let's look at the handout that I prepared for you. Look in the handout here. We're going to skip the medications. We'll get back to that. But the diabetic piece, I took out some stuff for you. Page 16. So here, I prepared for you, again, if the only thing we cover is just this stuff, is the only thing you remember, Dayenu, and that is, it's important to recognize the fact that, matzah, if you buy whole grain matzah, it's much better for a diabetic. What are the shiurim? So the Star-K has worked with the Jewish Diabetes Association, created the shiurim in conversations with Rav Heineman. So therefore, I was going to go through this in a more forensic way. We don't have the time. But I think it's important for you to recognize this. And even if you can read this on your own, but you see the difference regarding how much, if matzah that is whole wheat matzah, the grams of sugar in it, the fiber in it is a fiber that does not create the same amount of sugar for a diabetic than what we would call white matzah, the standard matzah. So diabetics should be encouraged to get whole wheat matzah. Don't wait till someone comes over to you and says, I'm a diabetic and I have a question. Be proactive in any materials that you're preparing. Talk about diabetes. In any material, in any class that you give, talk about it. And there's nothing wrong with saying, if someone is diabetic and has some questions, let's remember the halachas of Achai Bahem, please email me, and I'd be more than willing to work with you on this issue. Don't say we're going to have a special class for diabetics. It's just the people who are going to come are going to be far and few in between. Okay? So if we turn to the next page, you'll also see the issues regarding alcohol, wine. Again, the minimal amount of wine from a halakhic perspective that alcohol can have is 4%. So for example, there is like a, there's a wine that's called, I think it's called Kedem Kal or another one, what? Kedem Kal. Kedem Kal has more than 4%. I think it has like 6% or something like that. But if it's a non-dry, if it's a dry wine versus sweet wine, that's a pretty easy thing to figure out for diabetics, less alcohol creates a situation for a diabetic that it will be easier. If you took Kedem Kal, which I didn't do, and you ran it with this test, I'm sure the numbers would be less than the two numbers that we got from these two wines. So this is critically important. One more statement. That is, if you buy a wine that has 10% alcohol in it, again, assuming that some of you took some basic math here, okay? So you can dilute the wine in a way in which it's still halachic wine, halachically considered wine, by creating a situation where it's still only 4%. So if you do a simple, if you allow a diabetic to create his own brand of wine, right, with an additional hashkacha DS, diabetic sensitive, right, on it, stuff like that, you will help a diabetic get through the Seder without being lethargic, which is a small issue, and without endangering his health, which not only obviously destroys his Seder and his chag, but destroys his entire, or her entire family's chag. This is particularly true, I'm sorry, give me one more second, when you have, you know, again, women that are pregnant and have gestational diabetes and things of that nature, where they might not want wine but grape juice, where the same thing, you have to be concerned about these issues. Let's understand that if there's any challenge at all, you tell them not to drink the Arva Kosos. But we both know telling a pregnant woman not to drink the Arva Kosos, it can be a little bit challenging, and you might be able to navigate with the doctor about minimizing the sugar content of the grape juice or wine, and therefore allowing her to, or him, you know, who's a diabetic, fulfill the mitzvah and still be able to achieve the goals. Yes, I'm sorry, you had a question.
Where did this 4% alcohol come from?
If you go through the Star K thing, he has all the makoros for it also.
I'm looking, I didn't see it for the
I know, because I didn't give you the whole thing, I just cut paste the pages. I wasn't going to destroy multiple, I didn't print all of the handouts. I only printed the pages that I thought were relevant for the conversation. If not, I went through these makoros. You'll email me, I'll send you the makoros.
Okay. Also, this 1.9 ounces as a drink. That's assuming
the backer is only 3.8 fluid
right,
ounces.
Make sure you have a smaller cup.
Yes, 100%. 100%. Okay? But that's why I put this in here for you. You'll read it on your own and you'll figure it out. But I think that this is an important issue. Now let me, again, in our waning minutes of time together, we go till 2:30, right? Okay, so I want to just point out a few other things here. One is that, and this is actually, it's a good idea, it's just a good idea for people to do, for Rabbanim to do, and it helps in two ways. First, I'm going to deal with the halachic way it helps, and then, you'll excuse me, I'm going to deal with the other way it can help, even though I'm sure there'll be some cynical smiles with the second way. Even though I've already warned about the cynical smile. So let me say the first way it helps. And that is, there's nothing wrong with a Rav. And again, I was in charge of a kashrus agency that started as an agency that only had one store, and then over a period of time had like 40 or 50. The full-time rabbi, there's no way in the world I was keeping up with all the products. So I did a supermarket walk before Pesach, inviting people to come with me, but I brought the head mashgiach of the kashrus agency because his knowledge of products is 1,000 times better than my knowledge. I would have been sitting there with a silly guide back and forth about each thing, whereas he just walked the aisles, and I was just there to learn and also to be, if once in a while I needed to add something in, I was able to add something in. Okay? But doing a supermarket walk where you announce a week or two before Pesach that you're going to do a supermarket walk with your congregants is a wonderful thing. It's wonderful for a whole bunch of reasons. Here's the non-cynical reasons why it's wonderful. First of all, it's a bonding opportunity between the rabbi and a whole bunch of people. Most of them will be housewives that you must probably have no regular interaction with, because Rabbanim normally have interaction with families that are in crisis or other issues. But the standard housewife whose life is perfect and going well and stuff like that, Rabbanim don't have any lot of interaction with. And this is a nice way of having that informal interaction, you know, in an appropriate, obviously, environment, walking up and down the supermarket things. The other thing is, there's always issues that happen with new products. So frozen vegetables, there should be no reason why frozen vegetables are not kosher for Pesach. But there is a reason, because the same plants that deal with frozen vegetables are the same plants that also deal with pastas and other things of that nature. But, you know, there's all these changes that happen on a regular basis. Go through the aisles, you'll see what you don't need hashgacha for, what you do need hashgacha for, and things of that nature. And you're informing your congregants and not scaring them at the same time. Those are all the good reasons. The cynical reason, okay, but it's a nice reason. If you pick a store that you're going to go to, let's say, what's the closest supermarket here? You'll excuse my ignorance. Key Food? Hey, let's say you went to Key Food and you went with 20 people up and down the aisles of Key Food. Let's say you did that 2-3 times a year to help people out. And then you have a shul journal dinner and someone goes and says, we're the ones who do the thing. I told you, that's the cynical reason. There's a pretty good chance that they add that they'll support you. That's not the reason to do it. I'm just saying, as a pulpit rabbi, you should recognize there are other consequences that go along with it. L'hagdol Torah l'adira. You're not using that money to get a raise, although that's not such a bad idea sometimes. But you'll use that money to be able to promote Torah in a whole bunch of different ways. I just want to bring up a few more things in this handout. Let me just walk you through it. On page 20, pets. You know, this is a growing issue in some communities. So the Star K and the CRC have a whole list of pet foods. Again, you don't have to worry about kidney oat in this case, but you do have to worry about fomites. And it gives you a whole bunch of ways that you can deal with those issues. On page 23 is a very easy, and this is what I use, a very easy guide for mechiras chametz. Now, Rabbi Willig is the consummate expert on how to sell chametz to a guy. This is a very easy document of how to do mechiras chametz. What I would do is I would attach all of the forms which I showed you earlier in the Boca Raton Synod thing on page 23. It explains all the kinyanim that are going to be used. It explains why they're being used. It explains the times. It's very understandable. It explains all the different things that are happening. And it's, you know, read through it. If you have any questions on it, you can email me, and I will be more than willing to answer your questions. But it's really easy to understand. And it's easy for the guy to understand. It's easy for the Rav to understand. And it's, you know, a document of choice that I'm sharing with you. The countertops issues that it was asked, and you mentioned that, as you can see here, it explains how easy they are to kosher different ones. I wanted to give you that list, how to kosher different ones, page 25, 27, 28, 29, of koshering different things. There's a shopping guide in here from the CRC. I obviously didn't print the whole thing. I printed stuff that are not Chicago-based, but are based in other places. For example, you have to be like baby formula's kidney oat. So, but in a case of a chola, or a case where a person could become a chola, which a baby definitely that's having formula fulfills that, follows that, those protocols. So you would use kidney oat. You would have to clean the kalim in a different sink. Not in the sink where you're having all your chametz, all your Pesach dikka stuff. There's one other thing I wanted to point out here that hopefully I put in here, and that is medicines. And I think it is incumbent upon a Rav to mention this. There is a wonderful page, which for some reason doesn't seem like I put it in here. Hopefully I did. There's a wonderful page that is signed by Rav Gedalia Schwartz, the Av Beis Din of the CRC, as well as in charge of the Basin of America, as well as Rav First, who's the head of the Aguda and a major posek in Chicago, and two other poskim, reminding us the fact that medicines. I'm sorry I didn't put it in here, but I will get it to Rabbi Orly and I'll reconstitute this package with it in there, and I'll indicate what page it's on. But he mentions in there about we have to be very concerned about medicines. Medicines or vitamin supplements that the doctor says you need to take. Not vitamin supplements that you're taking just to make sure you don't get certain wrinkles or stuff like that. But vitamin supplements that the doctor says, listen, if your vitamin challenge on these issues, and if you don't deal with it, it's going to affect your blood or anything of that nature. Even if they're kidney oats, or for that matter, even if they're chametz, if they are going to be in a situation where you're going to put yourself in danger, especially if they're not liquids, but they're pills, there's not a halachic problem with them, and therefore it's important for us to make sure that we communicate those messages. The other thing that's important to recognize is the fact that there are different poskim that say different things regarding different types of cosmetics and things of that nature. It seems that if it has a form of an alcohol, that many poskim are concerned about those and say that it needs to be kosher for Pesach. But it would seem that many of soaps and things of that nature that are nifsal achilas kalav and things of that nature, like toothpaste, things of that nature, seems by many poskim do not need any type of supervision for Pesach. I remember once in the Rav Shir, he made the comment that a toothpaste doesn't require certificate for Pesach. So one of the students came back the next day and said, I fed a bunch of toothpaste to a dog. So the Rav turned to him and said, who are you going to believe, me or the dog, whether it's Rai Lechila's Kalev or not? So again, if you read through the CRC and the Star K, which basically are online, so it's not a big deal for you to get it, you'll see on cosmetics and stuff like that, they pretty much rule that the non-liquid stuff, because the liquid stuff actually can be used by even people, believe it or not, even people who are alcoholics can still be used as a form of getting their alcohol high. So basically, but stuff that is a solid substance, it doesn't seem to be a concern whatsoever. I would encourage you to look at the Star K and the CRC stuff in your free time and learn a little bit more about cosmetics and things of that nature. I'll actually insert some of that additional information in the documents that I prepared for you. So don't forget about the babies. Don't forget about the pets that some people, treat with an extreme amount of dignity and respect, as they should, if they have pets. And you have to make sure you respond. And most importantly, those issues, don't forget about the responsibilities that we have regarding medicines and for diabetics, and the recognition of the fact that simply the different type of wine you can use will make the difference whether a diabetic will have a challenging yantif or a yantif that has simchas achag, which is our responsibility as leaders to make sure that all of our congregants have an appropriate simchas achag. Okay, we'll stop here.
Thank you. We'll go downstairs.
Thank you.
Okay.
The New York Times needs to be removed before it was
on. I don't really care.
Okay. Okay. Fine. See you later.
Let me think about it.